Session number 12246, Lieutenant Colonel W. Waitman, Reel 3.
Colonel W. A. Waitman, Reel 3. As officer cadets on board the ship, Colonel, were you treated as officers or common, ordinary, ranking soldiers?
No, we travelled on the mess decks in the same way as private soldiers, and we were serial RZKOK India Command. The first week between the Clyde and Gibraltar was rough weather, and the first day many of us were seasick, but we gradually got our sea legs, and either through good routing out into the Atlantic and then eastwards towards Gibraltar, we evaded any U-boat attacks, which at that time were sinking a large amount of Allied shipping. We reached Gibraltar at night and passed through the straits in darkness. One could only see in the distance a large black landmass of presumably the rock, but between us and the harbour of Gibraltar, laid offshore at anchor, were two well-illuminated hospital ships, which of course were never attacked under international agreement. We then proceeded along the north coast of Africa, initially the Moroccan coast and then the Algerian coast, escorted by one aircraft carrier, a large carrier which lay astern of our troop ship, the P&O liner Multan. Three troop ships were put into Algiers and one or two of the merchantmen, and we proceeded with another troop ship along the coast. We rounded the Tunisian coast round Cape Bon. The Allied troops had actually captured Sicily, having recaptured Tunisia, and Cape Bon beaches, which we got a good view of, were by then completely deserted. And on our port side was the island of Pantelleria, which the Allies had taken as a stepping stone to Sicily. And we proceeded quite almost sedately through the Med. There was one afternoon when we were all confined below decks and aircraft were overhead and guns were firing, and we weren't quite sure whether it was practice for our gunners or whether it was an actual attack, but as no bombs appeared to have been dropped, there was plenty of bangs and flashes coming down the wooden stairways to the mess decks from the guns on the side of our ship. I had a quick peep out unofficially, saw an aircraft pass overhead which looked remarkably like the American fighter, the Bel Air Cobra. So whether our chaps, our maritime gunners, were firing at our own aircraft or not, I know not. And eventually we saw a host of masts in the distance of small ships, sloops and dhows and the like, and port side hove into view. The troop ship in front of us entered the canal first, and whether she discharged her passengers at port side itself or at the far end of the canal at Port Tewfik, I don't know. But we got a magnificent view of the entrance to the canal, close up with the statue of Ferdinand de Lesseps, the French engineer, pointing down the canal. As we proceeded down the canal, we saw anti-aircraft positions either side neatly laid out with sandbags and revetting in absolute spick and span order, well laid out tents, and some music banter between the gunners in the positions, which were at intervals from the north to the south end of the canal. This included such remarks as, "Where are you going, Blighty?" The reply from the ship, "No, Bloody India." Or, "Yes, via Bloody India." They certainly, to construct their positions, both the gun positions and the living tent accommodation with sandbag protection, there was no shortage of sand. Of interest, we saw Egyptian army soldiers wearing their tarboosh on their heads and World War I type uniforms, riding camels, plodding slowly along the banks of the canal between Port Said and Ismailia. Eventually we reached the south end of the canal at Port Tewfik, where the troop ship that had preceded us down the canal was lying at anchor and completely empty of her Royal Air Force passengers. We then proceeded down the Red Sea, and as we left Port Tewfik, it was October the 1st, 1943. That, in fact, was my 18th birthday. As some form of present, perhaps, or just good luck and tactics, we were allowed to travel down the Red Sea until we almost reached Aden, with the portholes open both by day and night, and this was particularly beneficial to the 3,500 to 4,000 troops on the mess decks of the Multan, alias the German prison ship Altmark II. We had taken on water at Port Said, where the Soviet ambassador, Mr. Maisky, was disembarked on his way back to the Soviet Union. And when we reached the harbour at Aden, we again took on more water. And this was our first big view of the local scavenging birds, the kite hawk, known affectionately to the brutal licentious soldiery as ubiquitous shite hawk. Having taken on more fresh water at Aden, we then closed the portholes at night and crept out in the Indian Ocean, Arabian Sea, escorted by one destroyer or frigate. Sundays was a very special day because there was a tremendously powerful Welsh choir on board, and their singing was all that is good, apart from rugger, that comes out of the principality. When we were 3 days from Bombay, on the Sunday evening preceding our arrival on the Wednesday of the coming week, the Padre held a Thanksgiving service, and during that I saw a sight which I shall remember to my dying day, of the choir really letting rip with that wonderful hymn, "All Hail the Power of Jesus' Name," to the tune Diadem, and silhouetted against the setting sun, the escorting warship was firing into the water. Again, whether this was practice or suspected periscope, I don't know, but there were definitely Japanese submarines operating in the Indian Ocean and up into the Arabian Sea between the Arabian Peninsula and Bombay and Karachi. We arrived safely after a month aboard ship and were ready to get off, stretch our legs and get down to Bangalore for our training. We had passed the time away with some language study as the senior officer conducting the draft was an Indian Army officer of the Bombay Grenadiers, and with some weapon training and relaxing, some boxing and deck quoits or deck tennis.
Was the discipline on the ship pretty strong, pretty firm?
Discipline was very, very good, and all ranks worked together and pulled their weight. In fact, the only misdemeanours that I can recall, four of us happened to leave our greatcoats on the mess deck tables one morning instead of putting them up in the rack on the roof for which we were awarded 7 days extra fatigues, and I was one of the offenders on that occasion. When we disembarked, we carried our sea kit bags with us, and we were wearing khaki drill and the old-fashioned British Army topi known as a Wolsey helmet, the type that General Lord Wingate wore in Burma, and in Abyssinia before that, of course. We left our kit under guard at the railway station because new arrivals in India were sitting ducks, an easy target, soft targets for the local loose wallers, as thieves are known in India. But we left our kit under guard at the Bombay railway station, and I and a couple of others went on to the nearby Maidan, where there's some cricket nets, and we bowled a few overs with some Indian civilians who were practicing at the nets.
What were your first reactions on arriving in India?
Very thankful to get there in one piece without losing any ships in the Atlantic convoy or in the Med or on our own from Port Tewfik down to Aden, which was comparatively safe, or on the last leg from Aden to Bombay. Large, impressive railway station, coolies everywhere and Indians. We were addressed by a senior officer who told us prior to disembarking that when we travelled from Bombay to Bangalore, we'd be in compartments with bunks, and he recommended the top bunk. In fact, once again, and it would do us the world of good, of that I've no doubt, the process of toughening us up. We travelled as private soldiers in ordinary third-class Indian railway carriages, sleeping on the wooden seats and sitting on the wooden seats with our kit in the racks. And the first thing we did prior to getting our heads down on this first night, the journey, the first part of the journey was at night, was to go into the loo, where there was just an open hole which you sat straddled with your legs and urinated or crapped. And your first job at last light was to go on a cockroach hunt and kill as many cockroaches as you could before they came out at night. We then were on the main line through the Deccan, and eventually, after a day and a night journey, came to the junction at Guntakal in the middle of the Deccan, Hyderabad state. Hyderabad Deccan as opposed to Hyderabad Sindh, the Hyderabad state. We then had another night's journey, and the following morning arrived at Bangalore. By this time, several of the cadets were quite ill, and three were taken off, suffering from acute diarrhoea. Before the first 8 weeks were over, three had gone down with cholera, one of whom sadly died. We arrived at Bangalore, and then by motor transport went to the officers' training school. We were received into preliminary company, allocated rooms, two cadets per room, in long buildings with a central corridor and rooms either side. Outside were the ablutions and toilets. The ablutions had cold water only, but nearby was an outdoor stove, wood-fired, where the Hindu caste of Bisti produced hot water in buckets, and one bathed in a tin bath. We did a quick wash and brush up, and then went for our first meal in the messes. They were large pre-war Indian Army messes of considerable age, but beautiful buildings with long, cool verandas either side of the dining room and the anterooms. And after a month aboard a very cramped troop ship under somewhat Spartan conditions, and a 2.5 day very rough journey in third class Indian railway coaches, to sit and have cornflakes, bacon and egg and coffee and fruit on the table with an Indian officer, army officer's wife, mess supervisor, asking us would we like any more toast and marmalade, and Jenny looking after us, we were greatly relieved to get there. The good lady's name was Mrs. Fluitt, and her husband, Colonel Fluitt of the 1st Punjab Regiment, commanded Flew Force, part of the 14th Army, with distinction the following year in Burma.
What were you issued then with uniforms for your station?
We still had the British on the rank, khaki drill, bush jackets, trousers and shorts, and the Wolseley helmet. So the first two or three days was taken up in getting completely re-kitted from the Indian contractor Shamshuddin of great notoriety. And we were measured and soon had new uniforms run up by the Dersey with short-sleeved shirts, long-sleeved shirts, khaki shorts, wide at the knee for coolness, and slacks. And the shirt cellular and bush shirts were very, very good indeed. It was good quality material, whether cellular or plain cotton drill. And instead of the clumsy, ugly-looking Wolseley helmet, we were issued with lightweight pith helmets. They're sometimes called a topi, but the correct expression, certainly in South India, was pith helmet.
Did you have to purchase any of this from any allowances?
No, it came out of an outfit allowance. And within the first month, the auditors got onto the track of this contractor, Shamshuddin, and ran him to ground. We were formed up into platoons in preliminary company. A preliminary company at that time was commanded by a very, very efficient and knowledgeable housemaster from Marlborough College in Wiltshire, Major Arthur D. of the Indian Army, and later in the 5th Maratha Light Infantry. Under him were several officers, and our own particular officer was a Captain H.L. Humphreys, who had been working in India for the BBC and had been commissioned in the 1st Gurkha Rifles. Each platoon was allocated a British Army warrant officer or senior NCO as the platoon instructor, and we had a chap, Sergeant Major George Collett of the Green Howards, who was excellent in every way and a father figure to us all. He would question us during breaks as to who was the commandant, who was the deputy commandant, who was the chief instructor, who was the commanding the weapon training wing. And one morning he asked us who was the quartermaster. None of us knew, and he said, "It was Major Hone. I've just been with others to pick him up off his bungalow floor. He shot himself because he'd been involved in the racket with a contractor."
This is the contract you referred to. And what had he actually been doing?
Overcharging. A board of officers sat under the chairmanship, actually, of Major Arthur D, and prices were slashed enormously.
What equipment were you issued with?
We had some very smart leather belt, pouches and cross straps and bayonet frog. We still wore the ordinary British Army 1937 pattern haversack and water bottle and the 1937 pattern large pack, but when one got cracking with the polish, the leather belt, bayonet frog and leather pouches and cross straps looked very, very smart indeed against the khaki drill. Our weapons were kept in a building which was called an arms coat, K-O-T-E. This was an armoury inside a walled compound, constantly guarded. And each cadet was issued with a rifle disc. And when you're going off on field training or weapon training and required your rifle, which was the number one short muzzle Enfield rifle, you queued up at the armoury, handed your disc in, and were given your weapon with the corresponding number of the disc. And on completion of your training, you returned again and handed your weapon in and got your numbered disc back again. and the disc number and the rifle numbers always corresponded. And this was absolutely essential for control of arms in India, to avoid getting into the wrong hands of civil activists or up onto the Northwest Frontier itself. It was a system that proved its worth, and we see what can happen when the opposite takes place in the Middle East and Africa today, where there are far too many arms, Kalashnikov, Simonov, and every other cough in the book, in the wrong hands, and has led to situations such as Beirut and the Lebanon as a whole, and the massacres during various revolutions in Central Africa and North Africa.
You mentioned accommodation, two cadets to a room. What kind of accommodation was within the room itself, furnishings and so on?
Each cadet had a charpoy, which was a bed frame with Hessian strips and a mattress on top of that. And it in some ways was not unlike a four-poster bed, because one's individual mosquito net was hanging from it, into which one climbed at night. And you had sheets, pillows and blankets. Of course, in the heat of the summer, you didn't need these. But we, having arrived there in October, it was just beginning, the winter was just beginning, or their type of winter, the colder weather was beginning to set in, although it never got really cold. There was a nip in the air at night, and when you're on night training or early morning duty, you often wore a pullover on top of your KD shirt. There was a writing desk and a couple of chairs and a couple of washing bowls. There was no electricity. You used a hurricane lamp. And in the morning when you went for a shave, you went together and took your hurricane lamp with you, or shaved in the bowl in your room with a tin mirror or an ordinary mirror. When we got into the main officers, part of the officers' training school, there was electricity there, but initially in preliminary company we hadn't electricity.
What was the food like?
First thing in the morning, roughly any time after 0500 hours, around about 0530, there were, each group of four cadets was allocated a bearer, an Indian bearer, and he would bring a small meal called a chota husri, a small breakfast. And the chota husri consisted of a cup of tea, mug of tea, two biscuits, and a small banana. Then you went off and did a couple of hours training, generally starting with PT at 6 o'clock. And then after two periods, back to change into KD and off for breakfast, usually at 0800 hours. Then lunch would be around 12:30 to 1:30, and then the afternoon training would commence. But we worked a six-day week, with Tuesday afternoon, Thursday afternoon and Saturday afternoon devoted to sports training, which one could play either cricket at the Gymkhana Club, or hockey, softball, swimming, and we generally did one if not two cross-country runs per week across Agram Plain, which was the main training area to the south of the Officers Training School in Bangalore. The OTS at that time was commanded by Brigadier L.B. Jones, later the 6th Raj Patana Rifles. His battalion captured Karen in Eritrea from the Italians. The Deputy Commandant was Colonel Coombe of the 13th Frontier Force Rifles, and the chief instructor was Colonel Delaforce of the Royal Scots Fusiliers. Commanding the weapon training wing was Major Adams of the Royal Ulster Rifles. And as I said earlier, our company commander for the first 2 months was Major Arthur Dee of the Indian Army and later the 5th Maratha Light Infantry, housemaster of Field House, Marlborough College, Wiltshire.
Can we just return to the living condition side of the school? You've mentioned the breakfast. What would the midday meal be?
The midday meal would be a curry, either curried fish, curried mutton or curried beef, and then you could have European dishes such as cold meat and salad. But gradually, most of us got hooked on the curry. And I must say, to me, curry is a passion. Evening meal again, European or Indian food. We were completely integrated and mixed in the Indian Army, and in our company alone, which was CC-59, cadet course number 59, commencing in the October of 1943, we had one Gurkha, a Gurung, we had one American, Peter Glenn, who had enlisted in the American Field Service, been captured in the Western Desert at Adam, taken prisoner to India, but then repatriated because he was not a combatant. And a second one joined us at Bangalore in the pre-officers training school company for our third and fourth month. And I shared a room with this American for the following 7 months until we were commissioned. And he was called Tom Lockley from Los Angeles, who had enlisted in the British Army before America came in the war, and had done his training in India at in England at Barnard Castle with the 54th Training Regiment Royal Armoured Corps, and was badged 17th 21st Lancers. We were all comparatively young at 18 and 19, and Tom was one of the golden oldies at the prime age of 35, a very fine man indeed, and a good little tough soldier.
What was the eating accommodation like in itself? Was there a general dining room for everyone, served everyone?
Yes, a large dining room with cloths on the table, cutlery, and Indian bearers wearing their pugris and their native costume and cummerbunds, the punka fans going in the roof. They were electrically driven, of course. And going back again to the complement of CC-59, we had Sikhs, Anglo-Indian, Anglo-Burman, Anglo-Portuguese, Punjabi Musulman, and various Hindu castes, including one Indian prince. Later on, in the senior school of the OTS, one Chinese officer joined us. And another very interesting character who joined the company later was a Chin from the Chin Hills. The Chin Hill tracts lie between Assam and Burma, and this chap, Delza Khan, was only 5 feet, 4 inches high, and in our athletics we saw him clear up to 5 feet, 3.5 in the high jump.
Was there any particular traditions for eating that had come up through the years that the school had been running?
The normal British officers' mess rules applied, and there were bowls for those Indian officers whose dietary laws demanded that they wash their hands prior to eating. We washed ours in the ablutions. If they wished to wash theirs at the table, they could do so with these small bowls of water, brass bowls, and then some who would prefer to eat with their fingers had it the bowl there to wash after their meal. And of course, the normal dietary rules applied. The Hindu officers never ate any beef or any bovine product. Equally so, our Muslim brother officer cadets, their dietary laws forbade eating bacon, ham, pork and sausage and the like. But there was complete integration and very, very cordial relations indeed, because we were all members of one very great army and part of the 2 million volunteers that the Indian Army consisted of in World War II.
There was no initiations or anything of that nature?
No.
No bullying from officers, or was there any particular officer that was that kind of person?
Not from the officers, but from some of the NCOs. There was a definite unauthorized policy of giving you a rough ride just to see what you would take. And we were all equally determined to take whatever was slung at us, because if one resented it, you could soon find yourself recoursed, back-squatted, and perhaps somewhere sent off to the base reinforcement camp at Dulali as private soldiers. And another small group, who obviously should never have even been selected for the Indian Army, a group of about four or five, and they were diverted as other ranks into the Indian Army Corps of Clerks, known affectionately as the Indian Army Corps of Sharks.
So the answer to all this is that you had to take it?
Absolutely.